Welcome listeners to another episode of the Indian Cycling Podcast. As promised, we'll analyze the week 2 of the Tour de France, and to do that I have Sandeep Krishna with me. Welcome Sandeep.
Hey Gokul, what an exciting week of racing this Tour de France has brought us. A lot of fun.
Exactly. I was thinking the stage 2, if I were to think of the entire tour as a single day race. The first week was a very dull preamble with nothing much happening in the beginning, and week 2 resembles a solid breakaway which has gone off, and week 3 is going to be about very exciting to see if the breakaway is caught. So it's been a super exciting second week, and I think the GC competition from something which was the most boring to the most exciting in just a matter of days.
Absolutely, Gokul. And typically, for a long, long time, the tour has a very predictable arc. And, you know, by week 1, we typically have a huge GC lead that looks like, you know, set in stone, and rarely ever, you know, we see it unfolding. Though the exception was 2020 when Pogacar did his magic on Planche du Belfil, the time trial there. But typically for the entire Froome era, as we remember it, then even Geraint's win, then even the last few, even the last year's one were very predictable in terms of GC, you know. Just one guy leading all the way from, say, stage 5 or 6 right to the finish.
Correct.
So this week 2 end has actually opened up the race quite a bit. And, you know, it would be interesting to place bets now of exactly what's going to unfold.
Yeah, but if I were placing bets, I would just go on the horse that you choose, Sandeep, because you have been bang on with regards to your predictions of what to expect on week 2. You were so clairvoyant and seemed to know exactly what is going to happen in week 2, and all your predictions came true. So hats off to you for that.
Nothing like that, Gokul. I think I just got a little lucky. And yeah, let's talk about the elephant in the room, really. Key event of the week.
Correct.
So why don't you just start on that?
So this was stage 11 on Wednesday. It was a very, very lumpy stage and a very hilly stage. So a lot of things were expected. The Galibier was there, and there was a 2,600 meters elevation gain. And we have always been talking for the last 2 years about what Team Jumbo Visma should do with regards to attacking continuously. And we even this year, when it became a more even playing field with Roglic and Vingegaard being both very strong about using the two man lead strategy to attack Pogacar, and that is exactly what they did. Roglic and Vingegaard kept attacking Pogacar, and it looked like Pogacar was on top of things, and he was able to mark most of those attacks. And towards the last with 5 kilometers to go, when finally Vingegaard attacked, he just didn't have the legs, and he got dropped, losing about close to 3 minutes. And as a result, he was behind Pogacar by about 39 seconds or so, and eventually taking the yellow with more than 2 minutes. And it didn't look like a stage of a grand tour at all. It looked more like a single day race. So it looked like a spring classic in terms of the attacks and the neutralizations. And it was an unbelievable day of racing.
Absolutely, and nobody really expected that, you know, this is going to turn out the way it did. And Pogacar, the most dominant rider of this generation, would lose 3 minutes on one stage. That was just unbelievable for everybody. And you know, so continuing on what we were discussing on the last week's recap podcast, you know, we saw Pogacar in week one going out for you know, sprinting for bonus seconds on the, you know, ramps on the finish line, and trying to gain, like, you know, a little trivial advantage on the cobbles, the Northern France stage. So we saw him extremely active in week one, and like I was saying, it looked imprudent to me that, you know, Pogacar was trying to gain a handful of seconds here, 10 seconds there. It looked an excessive, you know, effort in week one, where typically all we have seen riders being very conservative, trying to save energy for, you know, week three. And even on this specific stage, like we discussed, on stage 11, you know, when all the attacks were starting to flow on the penultimate climb, not even the final one, on the called Galibia, which actually climbs to 2,600 meters. That is considered high, very high altitude. Even there, every attack, even Roglic's attack, who was, you know, honestly quite down the GC by then. He was 3 minutes down, if I remember correctly, already. Even there, our, you know, Pogacar was trying to, you know, track all each and every attack by even Roglic. And then at one stage, towards the end of it, he was actually pulling, he was actually riding tempo solo in the wind, right to the top of Galibier with only Vingegaard able to match it. And it looked like a man in complete control who knew that, you know, he could not be defeated. That is the way he was looking. With all that, you know, signals of riding a motorbike also to the cameraman and all. And then, so number one mistake I thought he did on that was tracking all attacks, including Roglic's attacks. Number two, he was riding tempo, pulling Vingegaard. He was not even attacking him. He was just riding a steady tempo, dropping everybody, the entire Jumbo-Visma team of four or five helpers who were there with Vingegaard earlier. And he was riding all the way up to Galibier, which is a high mountain climb. And then third big mistake he did was on the descent, he did not push on. He just took it very easy, and slowly the entire Jumbo-Visma helper squad, including Wout van Aert, including Roglic, Kuss, I don't remember who else. So I think five men of Jumbo-Visma actually regained touch to this leading group. And Wout van Aert even went back to fetch, you know, Roglic, I think.
Yeah.
And they were gunning the, they were definitely, obviously, Wout van Aert and those guys were gunning the descent. And surely Pogacar didn't need to risk it, but he should not have let the dropped riders on Galibier, you know, connect back after doing all the work on Galibier, pulling Vingegaard. That was three huge mistakes he did, I feel. And apart from the entire first week where he was just, you know, wasting energy all the time. And then when on in 5 kilometers to go, when, you know, Vingegaard did his attack, he had nothing left. He looked empty, and everybody came back to, you know, him, including Geraint Thomas, Adam Yates, David Gourdou. Suddenly, Pogacar, the most dominant rider of this generation, was looking in like an average domestic who was, you know, being dropped by each and everybody. So, extremely, extremely unlikely turn of events that day.
Yeah, I mean, we were having, in fact, exactly the same discussion about half an hour ago before I left the store. So, my... it all started with the attacks, the alternative attacks of Roglic and Vingegaard, which Pogacar was marking. Obviously, he did not have a choice if Vingegaard attacked. But do you think he should have let Roglic's attack go? Why was there any more than the confidence, was there any tactical reason why he should have covered Roglic's attack?
So one reason could be that, you know, if Roglic, let's say, pulled a minute's advantage, then potentially Vingegaard could have attacked Pogacar and actually joined up with Roglic, who was a minute ahead, and then, you know, they could have time trial together, or, you know, helped each other together. So that could be possible. But a guy like Pogacar, who's a very explosive rider, right, even on the climbs, if he was feeling well to actually track these attacks by Roglic, he could have easily, you know, or he would have ensured that he wouldn't have left Vingegaard attacks go untracked. If you're only concentrated on defending and only following Vingegaard, I think he would have not wasted as much energy potentially.
I think it's also like just like how I was telling that you were very clairvoyant. I think Wout van Aert came back and made me eat my words. I think it's just the presence of Wout, which also probably prompted Pogacar to make this mistake of marking Roglic. Because like you rightly said, if Roglic had indeed taken a minute or so away with Vingegaard and Wout both behind, there was always the possibility that Wout could somehow manage to peel off Vingegaard and take him to Roglic, and then they going for it together ahead. So I think that must have, more than Roglic, probably he was scared of Wout.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, Wout is super strong, but just on a climb, on a high mountain climb like Galibier or even Granon, Pogacar is in a different league than even Wout, right? On the climbs.
Correct.
So, yeah, I think he made mistakes, and let's hope that Pogacar would have learned that he is also human. I mean, so far, we have seen him ride like a Superman, right? I mean, he did whatever he wanted to do.
Correct.
We don't generally see the yellow jersey pulling on the penultimate climb, taking the next challenger behind him. Generally, you see the other way around, you know, the challengers trying to attack each other, and, you know, the yellow jersey just trying to track the attacks or just trying to defend. But he was just doing the opposite. So we have seen him having no care or consideration to the old set of rules. But then we saw it actually coming back to bite him finally. Show us that he's, after all, a human.
Yeah. But again, many times in sports, we talk about playing to your strength rather than worrying too much about an opponent's game. Pogacar has been successful because I feel that he enjoys riding like this attacking, that merc-like hunger for winning everything, no? That unsatiated hunger. And that is what has brought him success, no? So probably that has been his strength, and that is what has won him the tours in the past. I understand that he has not had the luxury of leading from the front. Of course, last year he had, but last year also the untimely exit of and the early crashes of Roglic made things much easier for him. So he was not really tested that much last year, whereas with a reasonably stronger team, Jumbo-Visma this year, in terms of the availability of the people through to the end of the second week, I think that has really made the difference this year. But that is what I loved and enjoyed seeing Pogacar do. And we should also realize that he may be, it may not be his strength now. And also now we are in week three with him over 2.5 minutes behind. He cannot, he's not going to be able to win the tour by playing defensive by no means now. So I think he, while he might think about this in the what he could have done differently, he has to do exactly the same thing this week and hope that he can beat Vingegaard, right? I know I have jumped the gun a little bit in terms of the last week analysis, but somewhat he reminds me like Sehwag who is going and on a fourth day post tea session and still bashing the bowlers all around the park. So I guess that's his style.
Dude, absolutely, you're right. I mean, the fun of watching Pogacar is in what he does, being, you know, completely killed regardless of all the rules, not trying to be defensive, always on the attack. That's his strength for sure. But I think when, you know, it has actually bitten him for the first time, probably, you know, leading the tour and giving away almost a 2.5 minute of lead. Probably he would realize that he needs to probably neuter it a little down, you know, a couple of notches to still be as effective, as entertaining, but still winning it, you know, more convincingly and easily.
True.
However, like you mentioned, now obviously there is no other option left open to him. He has to go out on the attack. And I think we are primed for a fantastic week three now. It is going to be a lot of fun. Both the teams are now evenly matched based on what we are going to discuss next about the crashes in Jumbo Visma. And it's going to be essentially be a one-on-one contest now if Pogacar can actually drop Jonas Vingegaard or not. So we're actually going to see a one-on-one battle now, essentially.
True. So while we'll just let's take a break from seeing week three and let's quickly cover up some of the other things that happened in week two. We had a fantastic stage 12, right? With a small 5-man breakaway team going ahead and Thomas Pidcock and Froome riding beautifully. And it was so exciting to see Froome descending at 60, 70 plus kilometers per hour after what he has gone through 3 years ago. And while he did not have the legs to win the stage, he still came back third and rode a pretty very impressive ride, which you should be very happy and convinced about. It probably opens doors for a few more tours or a few more grand tours for him. That was I was really excited and so relieved to see Froome riding so strong.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the past champion that he is, it must have been very painful for him to, you know, have the break that he has had, plus the couple of years where he was, you know, a far shadow of the potential he has. And, you know, being on the front end of a stage of the tour would definitely bring a lot more confidence back to him. I think a couple of months back, I was reading from, you know, saying finally that he doesn't feel the effects of the crash anymore and the surgeries after that. Mm-hmm. So he's free to train, you know, like he used to as earlier, and that's something he knows how to build back his fitness. So that way, it's good for the sport that, you know, Froome is coming back to where he used to be in terms of being fit enough, being pain-free. But even on stage to Alpe d'Huez, where we're talking about, he looked a far shadow of himself, right? The moment the acceleration started on the climb, we were all used to seeing Froome, you know, high cadence and, you know, just zipping past all his rivals, putting, you know, putting him back in the dust. But it definitely he looked very different for others to be dropping him behind both Thomas Pidcock and Louis Meintjes, the other climber who came in second on that stage to Alpe d'Huez. Both of them could actually drop Froome on the climb, which used to be unheard of when he was at his peak. So I think it's going to be an uphill battle for Froome even from here on, if he can actually regain that last 2% of fitness that I think he's still lacking. Yeah, but yeah, we don't know. We don't really know. And knowing the tenacity that Froome has, he may even come back and, you know, again be vying to win another Grand Tour maybe someday.
Yeah, hope so. Yeah, I Grand Tour is, I think, is would be something for ages to remember if he does manage to win one. But at least if he's starting to win stages, that would be, I think that is probably more probable or more possible. Anyways, the other story this week was the rise of three different Danish stars, three different wins from Danish riders. The stage 10 was won, sorry, not stage 10. Stage 13 was won by Mats Pedersen from Denmark, who is a former world champion who had won in UK a few years ago. Then, of course, stage 11 was won by Vingegaard. And Magnus Kort won one stage. Which one was that? Yeah, that was stage 10. Right?
10.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So, very interesting week for Danish stars. And stage 10 also had a this week we also had two stages interrupted by demonstrations. Stage 10 was one, and wherein the whole peloton was stopped for 10 minutes to clear the demonstrations from the road. And it was a good win for him, and a good sprint win for Mats Pedersen as well. And did you have any thoughts on Danish these three Danish superstars?
I think it's interesting, right, how every few years we see the rise of a nation as well, right, in terms of dominating cycling. So about 5 to 10 years back, we saw the sudden resurgence, or not the resurgence, but the upsurge of the British riders.
Correct.
So suddenly we had Bradley Wiggins, Chris Froome, Mark Cavendish, even Geraint Thomas. So all of these suddenly coming up in the same generation. Before then, there were not as many British riders who were that successful. Sure, there were a couple of one or two of them in the past. But we had a generation of British riders, you know, dominating cycling in a way. Across sprinting, across GC, even on the track, all around. And then we saw Colombian riders, you know, coming through. Egan Bernal, and before that, Nairo Quintana, Miguel Angel Lopez. There's been a bunch of, Colombian riders, and they were, in such high numbers in each and every tour, Rigoberto Urán and so forth. So, and now, in the last couple of years, we are seeing a lot of Danish riders. So they've been quite silent so far. Mats Pedersen won the world championships, I think, 2 years back or 3 years back. And that's in some ways, it's looked like an anticlimax, right? I mean, he was an unheard of rider pretty much at that time, not so well known and winning the world championships. But they have been, Danish riders have been in support roles all along for years, and so many of them have actually done well. Even Jakob Fuglsang, who is in now the Israel team, but for years he was with the team Astana, and who won he won a couple of classics, monument classics, including Lombardy and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. So there's been a lot of success of Danish riders, and also probably one of the main reasons why Denmark was hosting the Grand Depart this year, right? This the first three stages that they hosted.
Mm.
I'm sure that will also create a lot more environment of cycling in Denmark, also encourage a lot more other riders to, you know, think of taking pro cycling as their careers. And I think we'll see a bigger surge, a bigger upsurgence of them.
Yeah, and of course, recently, just before Denmark, I think the country of prominence has been Slovenia with Pogacar, Roglic, and a few others coming up. Yeah, it's very interesting. However, I was listening to a podcast where they were saying it's not the sudden emergence, but it has been a process which has been which has taken years to build, and how the racing starts at a very, very young age in Slovenia. So the whole point of that podcast was it's not a sudden emergence, but it has been a process, and it is very natural of how the riders have evolved over the years and now are showing great results in the big races. Cool. I was also very excited to see it was a week wherein we had a breakaway success, and especially the win of both Michael Matthews and even Mats Pedersen was from a breakaway win. And Michael Matthews' win on stage 14 was very interesting, and the way he was attacked by Alberto Bettiol in the last few kilometers up the climb, and Matthews lost a few bike lengths, was hanging around there for a few minutes, and then managed to get a last bit of energy to overcome Bettiol, and finally beat him convincingly by a huge margin. So what did you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very interesting that Michael Matthews actually went out in the break, and I think this is among his few wins from a breakaway. He's typically been a very punchy sprinter, especially who does well on hilly, lumpy days, but here he was in the attack, and even from the breakaway, I think he went out in an attack early, leaving the others behind, and you know, the more purer climbers and all. And the finish was obviously very exciting, and I agreed with you that I thought that Bettiol was going to take the stage the way he accelerated past him and opened up those bike lanes. But then I think that's the fun part about these climbs. You don't really know how much deep somebody has gotten through in, and you know how much they are going to pay for it, especially with these super steep climbs that they were. And I think Matthews will take a lot of confidence from it. He used to be somebody like Sagan or Wout van Aert a few years back, somebody who could win in a variety of ways, including shorter time trials, even bunch sprints and these lumpy kind of stages. But he has been very silent the last, I think, 3-4 years. We have not seen him active much. I think this will give him a lot of confidence to come back and, you know, probably reinvent himself as a breakaway artist. So let's hope for the best for him.
Cool. Yeah. Sure. Anything else you want to talk about of week two, Sandeep?
I think one good sight for week two was Tom Pidcock winning on Alpe d'Huez.
Yes.
And Tom Pidcock was on his second Grand Tour. I think the first one was the Vuelta last year.
Mm-hmm.
And coming right into the Tour team of Ineos, which is like pretty much the toughest team to make through the shortlist. He has shown himself quite brilliantly. And, you know, I never expected him to be in the top 10 of the GC at the Tour. He appears more like somebody who would do well on breakaways, on attacks that he's been doing. But he has been pretty steady, and he has held the he has been wearing the white jersey until the time Pogacar was in the yellow. So it's been a very good tour for Tom, and then he just got the cherry on the cake to take the win on Alpe d'Huez.
Yeah.
He was just very, very good on that final climb, and there was no doubt about it that he was going to not win it. So very good to see him, you know, rise up another level.
Yeah, he's literally and figuratively on top, and on multiple tops also, in the sense that, you know, what a rider to somebody who is the cyclocross world champion, who is the reigning mountain bike Olympic champion, and somebody who has won on the Alpe d'Huez stage in his debut tour. I mean, that is quite a impressive resume, you know.
Surely, yes. And his descending was as fascinating as his climbing, and he looked like a daredevil descender, and that's something which would come in very handy for him and open up a lot more options in winning more one-day classics and other stages.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the way he descended, and I was quite surprised by the courage that Froome showed to, you know, try to not lose too much ground behind Pidcock Anders' descents. It was quite quite something to watch. So shall we move on to the next week and the strategy? What Pogacar should adapt, and what Team Jumbo Visma should do to retain their lead. Do you want to briefly take us through what is upcoming and what really each team will try to do, Sandeep?
Right. So before we even get into week three, Jumbo Visma had an extremely terrible last stage before the rest day on stage 15, if I remember correctly.
Yes, stage
15. And so it started with Roglic actually abandoning the tour. He was carrying this his you know, whatever, dislocated shoulder, back pain, and all of that injuries. And the team management probably decided to rest him and get him ready for the Vuelta coming up in, say, a month's time. And he abandoned the tour on the morning, on Sunday morning. And then on the day, barely an hour, a couple of hours later on, they had a crash in the peloton, and Steven Kruijswijk, who has been extremely useful to Vingegaard and Roglic in the mountains as a key domestique, he had a crash, and he actually cracked his collarbone or something, so something you know better about. And so they actually had to, you know, even Kruijswijk had to leave the tour right there with the injury. So in one day, they lost two of their best mountain domestiques, if you could call Roglic that. And then they had another couple of crashes later on where, you know, T.S. Benoot, who is part climber, part bodyguard on the flat stages and all. And then Vingegaard himself crashing as well. So extremely terrible day for them just before the rest day, and losing two key Michael mountain domestiques would actually play a huge role in week three. So currently their strength was having such a deep team with, you know, Roglic, Kruijswijk and Sepkus for the mountains, Wout van Aert as their all-rounder. He actually takes long pulls on the climbs as well. He is formidable on the flats. But then they have lost two of those major key mountain domestiques, with only Kuss as the pure mountain climber domestic left now. It is going to play a huge role, in my opinion, because they will be all alone trying to defend their huge lead. And so, like I was saying, that there are 3 days coming up in the Pyrenees, and they are short and steep climbs. Not so short, actually. Steep climbs on short stages. And lot of climbing to go. And three back-to-back stages means there is not going to be a lot of rest in between these days. And definitely Team Jumbo-Visma, depleted as they are, they're going to be completely tested by not only Pogacar and UAE, but also Ineos, who have been waiting in the sidelines. So I think we will see a lot of action in these 3 days, the 16, 17 and 18 stages. And if at all Vingegaard, has any weakness or any day where he isn't up to his top level, I think he will lose time.
Yeah. So I remember we were chatting immediately after the Wednesday stage wherein Pogacar lost his yellow jersey. So, and we were immediately doing some calculations as to seeing whether he can just rely on the TT on the penultimate stage to make amends. I think that is a bit too far, right? He's about 2.5 minutes behind, and that may be too much to make up on just the TT, right? So he will have to do some damage before that to regain the yellow jersey.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a 40-kilometer time trial, and although Pogacar has historically been a better time trialist than Jonas Vingegaard, but the gap between them is not super huge.
Correct.
So maybe he can regain, say, 30 to 45 seconds at max, a second per kilometer. But I don't think beyond that, Pogacar is going to imagine, you know, recovering any more time than that. So I think he would want to regain about 2 minutes to feel confident of winning it. At least 2 minutes in the next 3 days. Which is not going to be easy at all. Unless Vingegaard has a really bad day or he has some bad luck.
Yeah, and that is the other funny thing, right? These all being climbs, if he does make some time, he is very likely to make the entire 2.5 minutes, right?
I don't know. I mean, 2.5 minutes may not be. I mean, what we saw Pogacar suffer on stage 11 was very unusual, where he was like completely empty. Typically, climbers of this caliber may have a bad day, but you know, they may not lose minutes like Pogacar did typically. So even, I mean, to make that kind of a gap, not only Pogacar has to be on a top day, and Vingegaard has to be in a really, really bad day, or make a huge mistake like not eating enough or not drinking enough or something of that sort.
So, do you want to make a prediction, Sandeep?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What's the fun in not trying to make a prediction? Yeah, I hope there are no bets that we're making, but I think Pogacar is not going to be able to make up the 2 minutes that he needs to. I think he will go down swinging, but it's going to be an entertaining week, and he will probably make 30 seconds or so, 30 seconds to a minute max in the next 3 days. And that's all. I don't think he's going to make or recover more than a minute the next 3 days. So big, I'm just, that's my prediction, but yeah, let's hope we have a more fun week than that.
Yeah, that I am sure is assured, unless something drastic, unbelievable happens. It has to be a very exciting week.
Cool. Let's just hope nobody crashes out. There's no COVID in the key contenders from here on, and we see a true battle right playing out on the road.
Yeah,
that would be my wish.
Yeah, in fact, when you talk about COVID. There was something very interesting. I noticed that Rafael Maika, who's been supporting Pogacar quite well, he's actually suffering from COVID, but somehow the very strangely the organizers have allowed him to ride because he is deemed to be not contagious. I really could not fathom that, what really was meant by that, but that is what I read. So yeah, so cool. But somehow I have a feeling though that at the beginning of the in the preview on the week one, I was saying that I was, while I didn't see anybody other than Pogacar winning, I did want Roglic to win the tour. Somehow I think I am somebody who goes for the underdog. So and I have, however, have a strong feeling that Pogacar will make it, and he will. He is going to make up some time in one of these three stages in the Pyrenees, and will complete the the time gap and win the tour. Is what I think will happen. Of course, it is not logical. I think it is more an emotional decision.
That would be something.
Yeah, I just loved the way he rode, because I got a feeling that of the two guys, if you just see who is enjoying this process, I felt that it was very clear that Pogacar was enjoying this the most, and I have a feeling that he will capitalize on that. The fact that he is in the moment and enjoying this whole process. So that is the reason why I feel that he is going to take the tour this year. But time only will say. I know it's a very literally and figuratively uphill battle. And while I was reading discussing and watching various aspects as to the what is the strategies and all are likely to come up for this final week of the tour. I was reading somewhere about comparisons of what Chris Froome did in 2018, in stage 18. He was in fourth position, about 3.5 minutes behind, and a long, lumpy stage, and he went on an attack with 80 kilometers or almost... the Team Ineos did set up at that time, it was Team Sky, I think. They set up a very fast start for the day, and then he went on a solo attack in the last 80 kilometers. And it is legendary how he fueled for it. And in fact, I think one of the nutrition companies has made a lot of mileage around that fact as well. But I saw a lot of comparisons to that stage 18 and this year's stage 18 as well. So, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things have to go right, that the way it did for Froome in Giro 2018. Mm. And I can only hope that we see something similar in 18, and you know. Some miracle like that happens for Pogacar. And but yeah, I mean, it's something that would also imply that Vingegaard completely implodes or something for that to happen. Mm-hmm. Right now, even with the reduced team that he has, unless both the other previous days, the 16 and 17 stage, are so hard for everybody that his team is like completely broken, I think it will be very hard to pull it off in the tour. Giro tends to be a lot more unpredictable that way, mm. right? I mean, where the roads, the declines are more irregular, the road surface is not that great as the tour and as in France. Italy is a lot more unpredictable that way, but the tour is generally a lot more straightforward, predictable, declines are more engineered perfectly. So typically unlikely that kind of a raid to happen, but with Pogacar, you can never say no.
Correct.
Also, one more thing that I reminds me, Gokul, is the moment that Pogacar finished on Col du Granon, where he lost those 3 minutes. He went up straight on to Vingegaard, who was warming down, and he gave him a big grin and a smile and a handshake to congratulate him. And that speaks volumes about the guy. I mean, right after losing his jersey and losing 3 minutes, and you know, for pretty much everybody, that would be the end of their tour's leadership. There was not even 1 second of feeling of remorse or anger or frustration on his face. He looked as fresh as if he had won that stage. So amazing set, you know, sense of sportsmanship that is really, really hard to see nowadays from Pogacar. So another reason to root for him.
Correct. And another very interesting thing is I know some of these great champions are champions because they have learnt and adopted themselves. And in fact, very few people, I know you must have guessed by now that I'm going to go back to tennis to draw some parallels. Very few people will know that Federer was actually quite an angry young man when he started his career. And then towards the end, if somebody told you that, you wouldn't even believe. He had changed himself so much. Similarly, my son will curse me as referring to graveyard athletes. The same John Borg was called the Iceman for his cool attitude. Actually, when he was in his juniors, I think in his Swedish Davis Cup team, he was kicked out because of being such an angry and very McEnroe-like character. And it has said that they were poles apart in the, towards the end of their career, and nobody would believe. Similarly, if you saw this year's Tour of Flanders, when they had that three-way attack and he finally did not even make the podium, right? He was so distraught and so angry for losing it. And I think he was boxed in the final sprint, which denied him the podium as well. And he was so furious with the Van Baarle, right? So, and his team had to interfere and really calm him down. The same Pogacar just a couple of months ago. So that this shows that he has either that he has changed so much in such a short period of time, or he is playing up. He wanted to see Vingegaard and understand what he was doing.
No, you're right. I'd forgotten about that episode after Flanders, where he was throwing a tantrum. So yeah, I mean, that's actually very interesting how in just a matter of months, his behavior was completely different on although different occasions, but in a way losing out for something. So yeah, that's an interesting debate on, you know, whether he has changed as a person or he has learned how to deal with it, or he has composed himself to know that the tour is not over until the last stage is over.
Correct.
Yeah, we would never know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, I think two of the best scenes I remember from week two were both shots on the moto towards the last few kilometers on stages, both covering Pogacar. The first was on the day where he lost the stage 11, where he lost his yellow jersey, where he was mimicking the throttle, indicating, I don't know whether he was indicating that about the attacks or the speed of the tour. And the next day was, we know Europe and France in particular has been going through a heat wave kind of conditions, and they have been riding in 40 degrees centigrade, and the stage 12 was in very hot conditions, and Pogacar has publicly told that he doesn't ride well in the heat. And again, when the moto came close to him, he was joking and talking to them that it was a pretty hot day. I think those two moments really captured the character of Pogacar, and probably that's what swayed me to becoming a big fan and rooting for him this week. But I think they were two beautiful moments captured on the moto.
Absolutely, yep.
So if you were the DS of Team Jumbo Visma, what would you do to protect the yellow, Sandeep?
I think they have a very simple plan now, in a way. They have to ensure that, you know, they not basically, you know, keep a reasonably decent tempo on the climbs, let the breakaways go, take the stage wins, and with that, the time bonuses. And, you know, just ride at a conservative, but not a very low pace on the climb, so that, you know, you don't allow a lot of attacks to happen. And basically, they have to ensure that every attack by Pogacar is tracked by Vingegaard. I think that's all they can do, and really pray that, you know, Vingegaard is in the shape of his life, and, you know, they don't burn him by riding too hard in the next 3 days. And obviously, Pogacar is going to attack at every possible opportunity that he gets.
Yeah.
But the Jumbo Visma team has to just hope that their main man is ready for the job.
Yeah, and no, we also hope that all those attacks will deny him of a super strong TT on stage 20 as well, right? So if they survive those attacks and succeed in making Pogacar burn the additional matches, they are going to be in a much better shape and probably lose much lesser time on the stage 20 in the time trial.
Sure. Yeah.
Cool. So, anything else that you want to talk about leading up to the final week?
No, Gokul. I think everybody is super excited for the last week to start tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just hope that we see a battle right to the last day on the time trial, where, you know, both the riders have an equal chance to take the win. And we have a very interesting week of pro cycling that will, you know, bring a lot more fans anew to pro cycling. That's all I hope for.
Yeah, true. So yeah, I mean, I'm sure when we do the post tour analysis next week, we will touch upon the performance of some of the teams. And one of the things that we did not mention at all about this week is the performance of Quickstep, no, after a phenomenal start, wherein they almost had the chance of being the first team in history to win the first three stages, and taking the first two stages at least, they have been unseen, or they have not made any mark after the first two stages, right? So it's a very interesting turn of luck for them. And that is something we should cover next week.
Surely, yes.
Cool. So, thank you, Sandeep. Thank you, listeners. It was a great fun recording this episode, and it was real fun to watch the tour as well this week. Hoping for a super exciting last week this week. See you till then, and we'll come back with the final tour summary next week, post the completion.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sandeep. Bye.